Good morning. We're here for Holiness for the 21st Century with Dr. Carl Leth. Credits. Dr. Leth currently serves as Dean of the School of Theology and Christian Ministry at Olivet Nazarene University. He combines a PhD in historical theology with service as a specialized missionary to Germany, a senior pastor, including Detroit First, and is currently bivocational pastor of a multi-ethnic congregation, which is Kankakee Wildwood. Let's welcome Dr. Leth as he comes to us this morning.
Honored by your presence. There is a handout. If you didn't get it, you're welcome to take that, and it will serve as a guide for our conversation. And I do intend this to be, at least in a sense, a conversation. I realize it'll be mostly one-sided, but not a lecture, but a conversation with you about holiness for the 21st century. I want to say, first of all, I think this is a really important conversation. And as I have moved through my ministry, I become increasingly persuaded that this is a critical conversation, not in a sort of parochial, provincial, territorial way, but in the sense that this pertains to the very heart and focus of who we are and what we're about. And we are in a time when that is, I think, significantly in question. We are at one of those periods of a trajectory shift. And that makes this conversation important because it sets our direction as we move forward in important ways. So I think this is a critical conversation, one I'm passionate about. I'm so appreciative of the opportunity to speak into the conversation. I also want to say I realize I'm just one voice in the conversation. So while I may speak passionately about some of the things that I want to talk to you about today, I realize I am just one voice. I don't believe this is sort of the final word that should be like taken to the floor of the General Assembly and adopted or anything like that. There are other voices. There are other insights. I recognize that. So I want to speak to you today from the things that I see, hopefully as a constructive contribution to the broader conversation. And I come out of a particular context. We all do. So my context through most of my adult life has been pastoral ministry. For the last 10 years, I have been at Olivet, where I serve as dean and teach theology. But I'm also a pastor, as was said. So I'm a bivocational pastor. So I'm share that in common with any of you that are bivocational pastors. Great calling. And so I'm speaking out of that context. In particularly the context of being dean and teaching students, it gives me a window into the perspectives and conversations of young people as they come through Olivet. And I teach the theology sequence for our majors, but I also, through our other professors, get a window into the broader student body. And that raises for me both concern and hope, and it informs how I am thinking about this question. I think it's important for us that as we move ahead, that we think about the doctrine of holiness and how we use it and what we do with it, because I think how we choose to do that will shape the scope of our influence, our effect. And I'm thinking in particular about young people, whether or not young people will embrace the doctrine of holiness and see it as a critically formative value or not. And the answer to that question is very much, I think, in play. Now, as I describe the situation as I see it, I will probably, in one place or another, overstate the case, or it may be excessively stated. I'll just acknowledge that up front. And if you think, well, I've overdone it, then just see that as trying to make the point and not as necessarily a normative description. But I do want to draw attention to what I think some critical issues are, both in terms of challenge and opportunity. I think we have been largely impaled on the horns of our own dilemmas, which I think are false dilemmas. the doctrine of holiness has been captured by what is largely and often an internalized struggle. Again, this reflects my journey. Yours may be different. But through my years of education and formation and ministry, it has seemed to me, it's been my experience, that the doctrine of holiness has more significantly been an object of controversy and struggle than of proclamation. And when I came out of my educational process, my take the place that the doctrine of holiness sort of played in how I thought about things was I knew which side I was on. I knew which side had the right way to think about it and which side didn't have the right way to think about it. And so I knew that. But that's not very preachable. You know, you can't get up on a Sunday morning and say, I just want to let you know who's the right side here. The people are just not that blessed. And so as a result of that, I think that we've been immobilized. And from the outside, it's a strange phenomenon. You know, if you think of an outsider looking at us in the Church of the Nazarene, for instance, over the issue of process and crisis. Now, pretty much, I don't know of anybody on either kind of side of that, if there are still sides, who doesn't believe in both. So here we are, we all believe in both process and crisis, but it's how we nuance their relationship. And for the sake of that nuance, you know, we create camps and we battle with one another, and folks from the outside would have a hard time figuring out exactly what it is we're struggling over. Because in a broader context, it isn't really significant at all. But we have been preoccupied with these internal struggles to the extent that holiness became a point of contention or position rather than a doctrine to be formative and constructive, that you would preach with boldness. And so, by and large, for a generation, holiness wasn't really preached a lot, and maybe still not. I mean, that's probably overstated, but probably the second or third year is at Olivet, I did teach Doctrine of Holiness until Dr. Quanstrom came on faculty. And so we talked about the Doctrine of Holiness for a semester, and there were, I don't know, 20 students or so. And at the end of that, I said, now, most of them were Nazarene. I said, now, I just would be interested to know. Like, how many of you had heard this before you came here? I mean, not exactly the way I said, or just the same language, but, you know, basically this idea about the Doctrine of Holiness, how many of you would say, yeah, I recognize that? Out of a class of 20, there were 2.5. And so that's a wake-up. Now, maybe that's not typical. Probably here from the Mount Vernon region, they all hear it, or something like that. Maybe it's just Olivet's region, I don't know. But I suspect not. And because of that, the doctrine of holiness has become, or we risk it becoming, marginalized. It's a doctrine that is a kind of, we debate when we go to holiness conferences, or when we get to pastors' meetings, or some other kind of context, but most of the time it's not really relevant. And when young people see the doctrine of holiness functioning in that way, they're not really interested. Their lives are full of enough conflict. They don't need to own another controversy, and they don't perceive it as having a constructive, positive role, and so they just say, you know, you guys figure that out. We'll go do something else. And I think that's tragic. But we have, I believe, a rich, dynamic theological heritage. And the problem is not the biblical understanding. The problem, to the extent that there is one, is what we do with it. Folks, there's some chairs in here. I hate to see you stand through this whole thing, so feel free. So let me suggest for you some critical issues, as I see it, for us moving forward into the 21st century, that kind of issues that we need to think about or think through, and some directions that I would want to call us to, again, as one more voice in a broader conversation. The first is the need to recapture the scope of the doctrine of holiness. I think we have reduced the doctrine of holiness. We have tamed it in a way that would have been unfamiliar with the folks 100 years ago in the holiness movement. We have made the message of holiness primarily and narrowly about just the individual and the individual experience. Now, I want to affirm individual experience. I want to affirm personal experience. I'm not saying that isn't a part. It's a critical, important part. So hear me say that. I don't want to lose my job over this workshop. But I want to say we shouldn't stop there. Holiness isn't just about sort of my internal, psychological, spiritual assessment. And it isn't even just about what God is doing in me. Holiness has a bigger, amazingly enough, has a bigger image of what he's about than just what happens to me. Now, I'm glad I'm in that picture. I'm glad I'm a part of that work. But I'm not the whole work. We're not simply done when we deal with sort of individual personal vision. And the broader scope, holiness in its broadest sense, is about God's redemptive work, restoring and reordering a broken creation, which includes me, but it also includes us, and includes our community, and includes our world. God has a big project. And we have focused so narrowly that we've made it look like he just has a little project. And we miss the drama and scope and the power and the hope of this larger project that God is about. Welcome. Thanks. Good to have you here. That's fine. So we need to recapture the scope of the message of holiness. This is a big project that God is working on that is all-encompassing. And so it includes us, but it's beyond us. The second follows in part from that, to recapture the scope of the life of holiness. And now I'm thinking here about that personal experience. And what we think about is happening in that personal experience. And it's my perspective, my conclusion, that we have normalized a kind of adolescent spirituality. We have a reduced holiness, the way we think about holiness, to dealing with the problem of our culpability. Holiness is God cleansing us so that we do not willfully transgress a known law of God. If we do wrong, we do it accidentally, and therefore we're not culpable for it. Now, there's significance in those distinctions. But it reduces the scope of our attention when we're thinking about holiness. Well, are we holy? How do we think about holy? Well, I've got to test my intentions. Is it something that, have I done something I'm guilty for? Am I acting in any active ways in resistance or rebellion to the will of God? And it's all internalized, and it's all about guilt. Have I done something wrong? Is there something I'm supposed to do that I didn't do? That I did something with the wrong intention? Well, that's all well and good, but it's a kind of adolescent way to think about what we are doing and what we should be about. I have three teenagers in my home, pray for me, but they recognize that way of thinking. You know, if they do something that has a bad effect, the way they justify that it's not their problem is they say, well, I didn't mean to do that. And in their minds, that kind of settles the question. You know, I broke that lamp, but I didn't mean to do it, so therefore it's not a problem. Or I didn't do it because it wasn't my job. So teenagers, at least mine, have the amazing capacity to kind of focus, so they can be sitting on their iPad or watching TV or all the electronic things they do, and like stuff could be spilled on the floor, or there could be, you know, another child bleeding over here, and like to them, that's not their problem. That's not my job. So I'm good. And we have trained folks to think about holiness that way. Not my problem. Well, sure. Our manual says we're supposed to do good to the poor as we have opportunity. If opportunity ever sort of presents itself, why, I'll be open to that. You know, somebody shows up at my door and they've got a valid thing, but other than that, it's not my job. I don't have any wrong intention toward the poor. I don't think malevolently about the poor. So I think kindly about them. I hope that they all have wonderful lives. But doing anything bad is not my job, so I'm good. Now I'm saved and sanctified and purified, and my intentions are right, and I'm done. Now, again, I want to say, we need to get our intentions right. But holiness isn't just about dealing with my personal culpability. Holiness, if we connect it to this broader vision of what God is doing, transforming and restoring a broken, disordered world, and bringing it under His lordship, then my participation in holiness doesn't end when I get my intentions right. I'm engaged with all that God is doing, because that's what holiness is about. Now think about it relationally again. Think about if you did your marriage the way we do holiness. That's not my job. I didn't mean that. And then if you just stopped there, it's like, you know, it's your problem. That's not my job, it's your job. If I didn't intentionally do this in a way to hurt you, then, you know, your hurt feelings are your personal issue. Well, if you're married, you know how far that'll go. But we live holiness, the life of holiness in that way. No, in marriage, my responsibility as a husband is to, whether it's my fault or not, to give myself to trying to be the husband my wife needs and creating the environment that will be rich and helpful for her and for my children. My responsibility, my goal is to recreate this setting, this environment that I have leadership over in a way that shows love and hope and healing, whether it's like my fault or my responsibility or not. And I want to say that we need to re-engage the doctrine of holiness in that way. Holiness is not about just solving the problem of my guilt, culpability. It's about us being given with all that we are into partnering with God into the grand vision, the in-breaking kingdom of God that is healing and restoring a broken world. And that's a different vision of holiness that goes beyond a sort of adolescent preoccupation to a mature life that is holiness, love moving out into the world. Thirdly, I think we need to affirm the universality of the expectation of holiness while recognizing the uniqueness of personal experience. Now hang with me here for a minute. What I'm saying is, if you can watch, hang with my language until I explain it, that we need to move in our thinking about holiness, especially entire sanctification now, from that experiential event, from being understood as experientially normative, to theologically normative. Now, what I mean by that is, of course, normative references what should be the standard, what we expect. So whatever is normative is the normal expectation for human beings. And what I'm trying to say here is that our expectation for holiness as we experience an entire sanctification, this defining, decisive moment that I believe strongly in, that we need, though, to understand that essentially as theologically normative rather than experientially normative. Theologically normative says this is what happens in human beings. This describes the spiritual reality of a human being in relation to God. This is what is happening in their lives in relation to God. The reality of that, theologically understood, spiritually defined. Experientially normative says this reality, a transformed relationship to God, happens in a particular experiential way. And we have made the experiential description normative. But everybody experiences things differently. Generationally, we experience things differently. So I remember when I was in seminary, one of my classmates was describing his experience of entire sanctification. He said, I went to the altar, and it was like a bucket of cold water was poured over my head. Well, he's describing in the best language he can a really defining, transformative moment. But the doctrine of entire sanctification isn't about everybody having an experience where they go to the altar and feel like a bucket of cold water is poured over their head. Because then someone says, well, I thought I was entirely sanctified. I had this quiet moment of consecration and really settled things with God, but I didn't have any bucket of cold water, so it must not be true for me. And we have young people that don't have the same kind of experience. And so they say, well, I haven't had that experience in that way, emotionally, experientially. So I must not have entire sanctification, or that's not something I want. And so then they say, well, because we don't share this kind of emotional experience universally, then it must not be a universal experience. Are you tracking with me? If we all didn't get a bucket of cold water, then not everybody gets entirely sanctified. Well, you know, folks are folks. And I've been a pastor a long time. And there's some folks that are just like this. I mean, highs, and low. And then there are other folks, you barely get a pulse. You know, they're just steady. Now, those people are going to have different kinds of experiences, but they're going to have the same theological experience, the reality. And I don't want us to say, well, because everybody didn't have the same kind of experience, everybody didn't have the same kind of reality. I want to say everybody has this reality. Everybody should have this reality. This is the universal spiritual journey that God has in mind for us, but we may experience it differently. And we need to disconnect those two, or we'll lose the one for the sake of the other. So allow a diversity of emotion and experience, but affirm the universality of this journey to God and what it means. Fourthly, preach holiness as good news, moving from standard to possibility. Partly this has to do with sort of thinking about holiness in terms of legalism. But more broadly than that, it is thinking about holiness not as a definition of what life looks like, but the possibility of living that life. And here's where one of my pet peeves, you don't have to own it, but the Holiness Manifesto, for instance, is a nice project. It described what holiness is. But it just described sort of standards. It just described ways you're supposed to live. And the reality is, you know, holiness for Wesleyans is not different from holiness for everybody else. I mean, I'd be a little concerned if it was. Like the standard of what it means to be Christ-like is different for Nazarenes than for Methodists or somebody. You know, holiness, in the broadest sense, is holiness. The critical difference of the holiness tradition is not in what we understand holiness to be. Now, there are nuances to it. There are important aspects to that, how we've lived that out, our connection of personal holiness and engagement with the poor. And there are dimensions of that that are significant. But fundamentally, the holiness movement has not been different because it had a different way of understanding holiness. What was different in the holiness movement was that we believed it was possible to live that life. It was the possibility of holiness. And when we preach standard, then people just understand holiness. It sets the bar that you need to reach. It's like going to the amusement park, and in order to get on that ride, they've got, you know, a clown there with his arm out. And it says, in order to get on this ride, you have to be this high. My youngest son is a daredevil, but he's small. He's old enough now, he gets to those. But a few years ago, you know, he'd be coming up to those, and he'd be trying to stretch up and try to, in order to try to meet it, because he wanted to be on that ride. And we create we create people who understand that's what we're about. We're trying to get you to stretch up far enough to meet the standard. Now, there ought to be standards. I'm not saying holiness ought not to have sort of criteria or qualities. It should. But the power of the message of holiness and the holiness tradition has been not the standard but the possibility, the belief that it is the power of God is available to be at work to change us now in this life for anybody, anywhere, with anything. Well, that I like to preach that a lot better than I do, you know, you got to measure up to this. It's good news. The standard still, we still have what we're reaching toward, Christ-likeness, pure heart, all those things. But the heart of the message is in the good news of the possibility of God's grace that invites us into that in a powerful way. My concern is, I'm not sure if we still believe that. I think about where we came from. And if you've heard me in these before, you've heard this before, but you can hear it again. You know, Nazarene churches used to be all in like the worst place. Nazarenes had the worst realtors of anybody. You know, somebody would offer us a piece of land cheap that was down this back road, you turn right, and then it's behind the, you know, it's the worst possible place. And then we had these kind of standard box churches that we built, like thousands of them. And we didn't have the best trained pastors, and we didn't have the great stuff. You know, we were on the wrong side of the tracks. And I have found myself in recent years captured by this, the thought of this. How in the world did we get from there to here? And now, you know, the Presbyterians got nothing on us. You know, we've got nice buildings, and we have educated pastors, and sound systems, and top-notch video, and we've got it all. So how do we get from there to here? And I'm persuaded that the people that met in those poor locations, in those minimal facilities, were energized by this expectation. That God could break in anytime, anywhere, and do anything for anybody. And they came into those old, musty buildings, focused not on the decorations, but on the expectation that God could break in anytime. Service could be changed, preacher might not get to preach. You never knew. You had to come into service sort of keeping your eyes open. Now we got all the good stuff. Beautiful buildings, great equipment, well-trained clergy. And I wonder how many of our folks come into those facilities on a Sunday morning with a sense that you just never know what's going to happen when we worship. God could break in, anything could happen. My suspicion is that most people, most Nazarenes, go into a Nazarene church on a Sunday morning with much more modest expectations, hoping the music will be good or the pastor preaches a good sermon. When I talk with my students about times when God would break in that I can remember, when through a song or in prayer time or you know, before the message or in the middle, God would break in and people would move to the altar. And not just emotional stuff. I mean, we have our issues with that. I realize that's true, but it wasn't all that. When people who with really broken lives would find their way to an altar and they would kneel as a broken person and get up, healed and restored with new life. And the people would gather and pray and celebrate. And when I talk to my students about that, you know what their response is? Well, that sounds really good. I've never actually seen that in my whole life. So if you've never seen that in your whole life, why would you come on a Sunday morning thinking anything could happen today? No matter how broken people are, they could be healed today. No matter what kind of relationships are estranged, they could be restored today. So the message of holiness as the possibility of God's grace doing what only God's grace can do is the heart of the message of holiness. And it's good news. The next thing is to think about the affirmation of the importance of secondness. And in a sense, it ties to that last pointer. There's a lot of discussion about secondness and whether we ought to kind of forget it. Part of it's tied back to that experiential thing. People say, well, I didn't have an experience in that kind of way, so it must not be true for me. So let's say, well, it happens to some people, good for them, but it may not happen for everybody. That's where I want to get the theologically normative, to say, no, it does happen to everybody, just happens in a different way. But I also want to say that affirmation of secondness is, to my mind, critical, not just as an affirmation of the sort of sequence of God's work in human lives, but as a statement of expectation. And if we remove the expectation of secondness, I think we diminish or remove the expectation. That is, a part of the power of the secondness, the expectation of entire sanctification, what Wesley does and the American Holiness Movement does, is it moves the expectation of the possibility of holiness into this life. John Calvin believes in entire sanctification. He just doesn't think it happens until you die. But what Wesley does and the American Holiness Movement does is it moves it into this life and says, it can happen here. God can be at work in a radically transforming way here and now. You don't have to just hold on until you die, but it's in this life. Now, Wesley envisions it typically later in life. The American Holiness Movement moves it earlier, and we can get back to one of those internal debates later. But the critical piece is it moves it into this life. It's an expectation in this life. And it says then, our expectation, our normative expectation for every Christian person on the way to God is that in this life, it is not only possible, but it is our expectation for them that as they're obedient and follow and God leads them along the way, every journey is different, but every journey leads along the same path, and God will bring them to the place where they can be totally consecrated, radically transformed, captured by God's grace, and enter into a new kind of relationship, a level of relationship with Him that is given wholly to God. That's the expectation for every person. Now, if we take secondness out and we say, well, sometimes secondness happens and sometimes it doesn't, what we do is we move the expectation, the normal expectation, back out of this life. We say it can happen, but we don't expect it to happen. So the affirmation of secondness to me isn't just about a chronology of religious experience. It is about saying this secondness is a statement about our expectation of the possibility of God's grace in this life. And I hope we don't drop it, because it changes then fundamentally. The Christian tradition as a whole thinks it's possible. Augustine acknowledges it is possible to achieve Christian perfection in this life. Now, is that a surprising thought? He explicitly says it's possible. It's just not likely. God can do whatever God wants, and in exceptional cases He might do that. But normally, and what we've said is, no, normally, God works in a radically transforming way in this life. And secondness is a theological marker that says it's in this life for every person. That's our expectation. The next one is to nurture the life of holiness, to move beyond decision to formation. The late Dallas Willard critiqued the Christian tradition, the holiness movement, for our failure to produce holy people. because his critique was, we got people to make a decision about holiness, but we never trained them to live holy lives. And we became, over time, a tradition that focused on decision, but then didn't do a lot with formation. Now, I think early on, we did both. We never heard of the language of spiritual formation or spiritual practices, or we just did what we thought was good to do. And so, somebody would be saved or sanctified at an altar, and the saints would be there, and they would say, okay, now let's meet tomorrow for a Bible study, and then on Wednesday night we've got a prayer meeting, and Friday night we've got a cottage prayer group, and Sunday morning we've got Sunday school, and then we've got worship, and we've got service on Sunday night, and for young people we've got an NYI service at 6 o'clock, and we embedded practices of formation into the life of the church. We were actually a lot better at spiritual formation than we thought. But now we're enlightened now, so we don't have church on Sunday night, and we limit all this down, and we're intrigued by the notions of spiritual formation, but we've lost the practice. And so for a period of time, we still focused strongly on decision, but then you'd be entirely sanctified, and we say, well, praise the Lord, good for you, good luck, and we'll see you next year at camp meeting. And then we're surprised they didn't show up again. A part of holiness is just work. Part of holiness is just learning how to live differently. We can desire to live in a new way, but we have to change the habits and patterns of our lives. I can decide to lose 50 pounds, which I need to decide, but unless I couple that decision with a purposeful, intentional plan, I have to get the ice cream out of the freezer and keep the chips out of sight, and then that will before long surrender to pattern. And we need to teach people how to... Now, you don't habituate holiness. For any of you that are tuned into that conversation, we're not talking about habituating holiness, like training ourselves to be holy, but we are talking about learning to live in ways that reflect our commitment to holiness, to be the people we've chosen to be. And we need to train people. Now, we're doing that more, our commitment to discipleship, and I want to affirm that. And I guess, in a sense, we probably need to also recapture the decision, because we don't ask for decisions as much anymore either. We just kind of meander. I'm not trying to say, I got white hair, so... I'm not trying to say we need to go back, 20 years and do it exactly the way they did there and sing 6 verses of Just As I Am at the end of every service. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that we need to call folks to decision. And by the way, young people are not averse to that. Young people want to give themselves decisively to something. And if you're just kind of meandering around out there, they're not probably interested in that. So we're not really helping ourselves by avoiding a call to a response, at least with young people. Then practice the life of holiness. I was really intrigued before the last General Assembly, all the conversation about Article 10, and I was part of one or two email discussion groups and proposing drafting the language and drafting in a different way and discussions about the best vocabulary and all of that. And I followed that for a while and then I just quit. The reality is the doctrine of holiness will recapture the life of the church when it recaptures the people living in the church. And we can draft Article 10 however we want. We can draft it in heavenly language. But it's not going to make us holy. And I can't take that back to college students and say, here it is. Look at this Article 10. Is that a piece of work? Look at the eloquence here. Give yourself to that. The most persuasive argument for or against the life of holiness is the witness of the people who claim it. And I had some of both in my life. And there were folks that gave witness to the life of holiness that my response was, or would have been, you know, if that's what holiness is, I want to make sure I don't ever get it. Because it looks terrible. It's mean, and mean-spirited, and cold, judgmental, harsh. I don't want that. On the other hand, I've had people in my life, and these are the people who have held me to wrestling with this doctrine. People whose lives gave witness to something that was more than just religiosity, to something that was more than just rules. Lives of gracious tenderness and humility and love and compassion. I remember one of my parishioners at Detroit First, he was retired then, but talking about his parents who had been part of an earlier generation. I remember a conversation with one time, he said, you know, they were very legalistic, excessively legalistic, but there was something about their lives. That's what held him. That's what kept him, saying there's something about this doctrine. And so it's important how we draft Article 10. I'm not indifferent to that. I'm a theologian. I have plenty of ideas about that. But what will capture the church, what will capture our young people, is the witness of people who live out a life and they look at it and they say, you know, I don't even know if I believe all this stuff, but there's something about how these people are living that draws me. And makes me want to say, you know, I'd like to live like that. So we're not going to win the battle of holiness on the floor of the General Assembly. But when in the operation of the GMAC, the district office, the regional university, the churches, holiness is an aroma. It's a quality. And it's not that we're perfect. I can say, you know, they're too legalistic, but there's just something about how they live. Holiness has to be lived. It's caught more than it's taught. And we have to own that. I mean, for Article 10, we can blame whoever's voting. But wherever we go to church and whatever churches we lead, in those communities, they are looking for folks whose lives a model, a quality. And the witness of my own story is it doesn't take everybody, it just takes some that say something special is possible. Even if I don't see it everywhere, I see it somewhere. And that's a part of the future of holiness that starts with us. Lastly, to be a holiness people, that is, I think we need to move our understanding of holiness from thinking of it as a distinctive doctrine to a defining doctrine or an orienting doctrine. By distinctive doctrine, I know there are ways theologically to justify this, but when we think about a distinctive doctrine, we tend to think about some kind of distinctive, extra, special, on the side thing that we have that the Baptists don't. And it becomes then a gateway issue. So in order to be a part of this club, you have to be willing to agree to the doctrine of holiness, and you have to be willing to say in some way you believe you've experienced it. But once you get past the gateway, you're done. So, if you're going through the Board of Credentials, I see some of my students here, former students, they've got to deal with that process. And, you know, I'm on the Board of Credentials in our district, and we're going to ask that question. But it has to be more than that. It has to be more than a box you check. And for the holiness movements, the holiness people in the early days, it wasn't just a doctrine you had to agree to. It was the way of understanding our relationship to God that filled every part of who we are and what we do. And even in their affirmation of the secondness of entire sanctification, that expectation, that understanding of the possibility of what God is doing and the vision for the scope of what he's doing formed their engagement with the world. So it wasn't just when I'm saved and when I'm entirely sanctified that God works with power. It means God works with power all the time. And it means I may have been entirely sanctified 20 years ago, but the God who does that is the God who's available to help me in this moment, in this problem, with this situation. It's an expectation of how this works. What's going on here? And it formed all how they thought about life. And informed their vision, and informed their sense of the scope of possibilities. I'm from Olivet, so forgive me from the other schools. But Olivet was started in the middle of Illinois, like on this farm. The most unlikely beginning. You know, a group of farmers, I don't think any of them had been to college, and in the middle of nowhere, and believe me, central Illinois is like nowhere. And so in the middle of nowhere, they decided to start this school, and they call it Illinois Holiness University. The presumption of that is just stunning. But those early holiness people thought they were changing the world. Their expectation of the power of God being at work went beyond just what happened in their individual lives, and they thought they were bringing the kingdom of God. And so they just had this boldness. I love it. Out in the middle of Illinois, and here we are today. All of that is an amazing institution. How they could have envisioned that as a possibility, I don't know, but I'm persuaded it was the understanding of holiness. Holiness shaped their vision, understanding of the world and their relation to God and what God was doing, what God could do and would do and what he wanted to do. And holiness needs to become, in my view, just my voice now, but in my view, I think holiness, including entire sanctification, but the broad vision of holiness needs to become the defining, orienting vision for us. It ought to shape who we are and what we're about. We aren't simply Baptists with an extra doctrine. You know, like in every other way, we're just like everybody else, and then you have to have this extra thing. Well, that's marginalized. It becomes useless. Some years ago, I was in the K-Church program, and I appreciated that program, and Dr. Sullivan was a wonderful man. I don't mean to be critical of him in any way, but it struck me in that program, as a three-year program with church leadership and management ideas, and nowhere in that was the question, well, how do we process that as Wesleyans? You know, we'd have Baptist guys in and other folks come in. They're wonderful people. I don't want to de-Christianize them, and they were doing amazing work. But like along the way, isn't there some place where we say, well, given our commitment to holiness, our expectation, our understanding of what God is doing and how he's at work, how do we process this? How do we think about this work differently? And it ought to become an orienting, defining doctrine that shapes who we are and what we do throughout. Not just a church that has holiness, but a holiness church. Now, just a few thoughts, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions, I think. My concerns about the future for holiness is, there are several. One is the fear that we will move into generic evangelicalism. You know, God loves them. I'm not against them. I'm not being critical of them. But that's not us. And for us to just kind of blend in, I think the kingdom is diminished. I think those folks are diminished by our failure to attend to what God has given us. Or the marginalization of holiness. We affirm it, but it's functionally irrelevant. We check the box, but then we go operate from other values. And I think this is a real prominent one, an abandonment of the optimism of holiness, the expectation. Young people that may be persuaded to say, you know, that's a great story, that it's neat that happened in the 40s, but it's not realistic. You know, we live in a broken world where people just aren't really changed. They're too broken. And it's a nice fairy tale. But it's excessive hope. We need to rein it in. And that's already happening. On the other hand, I am gripped by the possibilities, the opportunities of holiness. And one of the things that captures my optimism, I guess, in a certain sense, is the pervasive brokenness of sin. We live in a broken world. I mean, you can, with folks that don't believe in the Bible at all, you can but begin with the assumption they understand the doctrine of original sin, universal sin. They live in a world just broken. Relationships are broken, governments are broken, society's broken, human lives are broken, marriages don't last, relationships don't hold up, people do things, they understand the brokenness of sin. Well, we can start there. And then the message of hope that says this doesn't have to be the end of the story. This pervasive brokenness has an answer in the radically transforming grace and power of a God who can make holy. Now, we may have a challenge persuading them to believe that it's really possible or true, but if it were possible or true, there's a whole world out there that would like to think it would be. And maybe it's waiting for some folks who could model its possibility and proclaim it as possible. And then lastly, the scope of the vision of holiness. The project of God, once we move it away to include the personal, but the broader vision, is such an engaging, powerful vision of what God is doing. We have young people in the university who say, well, I'm a Christian. I go to my local church. I believe in the Church of the Nazarene, and I'll attend. But a real passion of my life is to go out here and help the world be healed. They've got the idea that is different from this. That church is about where you get justified and you're not guilty. And then if you have a positive project, constructive project for changing the world, that's what you do outside of church. And they want to do that. They want to change the world. They want to make it better. And the doctrine of holiness says you don't have to go outside the church to do that. It's precisely in the vision of a holiness people that is possible. But we have to expand the scope so that we understand that dealing with AIDS in Africa and dealing with issues of ecology even, those are holiness issues. This is my Father's world. And bringing into the right ordering of His reign, that's what holiness, it includes all of that. And that is essentially the mission of holiness. And we can try it outside of holiness, but in fact, God's work is the only project that has a chance to be effective. You can send all the social projects you want, you can send all the money you want. The only way to change this broken world is by God's work. So we have this great vision. You don't have to go anywhere to be engaged in the broadest, most compelling, powerful vision of work in the world, because it's what God is doing. And if we can engage folks in that, it's a powerful, compelling, drawing vision. Well, one last thought. I'm not a big fan of slogans, so I'm sure we have to have them, and we'll have a new quadrennial or quinquennial or whatever annual we've got. We'll have a new one, but I'm not a huge fan of them. But I have one that I have. When it first came out, I thought maybe it was hokey, and now as time goes by, I find myself thinking, I love that theme. Holiness, the hope. I believe that's true. Okay, thank you. We have 5 minutes here in case there are responses or questions. Yes.
Are there issues that you see, particularly someone who works very closely with a lot of younger people, I guess, that our conversations about particular incarnations of holiness that the church, as you see it, is not prepared to engage young people on?
Well, I think we're struggling with this broader vision.
Okay.
So I think we still, as a church, that's why I'm trying to make this case, struggling to see some of these issues as falling within the scope of the work of holiness. And so things like justice in the world, or working with the poor, or ecology, we still will tend to see those outside. I just would like to say I think we don't have to.
Of course, holiness is what I long for. I've heard different views on whether that's correct theology or not. Care to comment on it?
Yeah, the question is about the chorus, holiness is
what I need.
You know, I think it depends on kind of the meaning. The lines are so simple, it depends on the meaning you are adding to those. So one issue of choruses is you interpret them. When you're announcing them, one of the ways that you frame the meaning is to say, now we're singing this song, and this is what we're saying when we say this. This is what this is meaning, and you can give it meaning. Okay, thank you very much. You've been a great audience. I'm honored by your presence.